Hello, everybody. This is the Gingerbread Man, and I would like to welcome you to my home. Thank you for being here. Appreciate you showing up. I have been busy, 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 busy. Like, no joke. I have literally had something to do every single day for the last 2 weeks. So about, not this weekend, but last weekend, I went to a wedding up in Loveland, Colorado, which is about 100 miles away from where I live. It's like a 2 hour drive each way. It was an outdoor wedding, and it was 33 degrees and snowing, which is really pretty because all the trees that had grown around this park that we had all met at for the wedding, none of the leaves had come in yet, so they were all like sort of skeletal, and the snow falling had collected on all the tips so that all the trees looked like cherry blossoms, and the pictures that she got were great, and I've always found myself fond of weddings, the ritual aspect of it all. I like seeing people happy. And this, like I said, this ritual is intoxicating in a way, and I always enjoy being around it, which surprised me because I thought I would always be a stick in the mud about it because of my previous counter opinions about things. But it doesn't matter what you feel about somebody's ritual. If they invite you in to be part of it, that can be very nice. And then yesterday I had a concert, but because I haven't had like a day off in 2 weeks, like this was like the last day of that 2 week sprint, and I had to work yesterday morning and then met at my friend's house, and then we drove up to Denver to go to Garden of the Gods, and it was Sublime and Cypress Hill. And then this rapper guy that I did not recognize named Mousetrap. And it was cool. I enjoyed it. It was beautiful. And it was cold and snowy and I was wet. But yet again, just being in that environment with all those people, all those beautiful people, just happy to be there in that space. It's intoxicating, and it's a very different ritual than a wedding, but I feel it's definitely a very human thing, and it made it all worth it. It was amazing. I was so high. I ate a bunch of edibles, and me and my buddy smoked like 10 joints, and then I bought like a tall can of beer, and so I was feeling pretty comfy, and it was really, really nice. And like, I grew up listening to Cypress Hill, and like, I know they've been around a lot longer than I've been alive, but like, my buddy said at one point, he's like, man, I feel like I'm 17 again. And he's like in his 40s, and I'm like 29. And I was like, me too. But it's accurate. But you know, that idea of childhood, that idea of youth, we were both tapping into it, I feel like. And it was just as applicable, even though logistically it doesn't make sense. Like, I used to smoke pot in my dad's house constantly as a child, and he hated it. He'd get so mad, and he'd be like, you're not supposed to smoke marijuana in the house. It's illegal. And he'd have, like, all these fucking, like, he kicked me out of the house several times. But still, like, almost every single day that I've lived at my dad's house from the time I was 13 and onward, I had smoked marijuana practically in his house or outside of his house. And like, all of freshman year of high school, I remember putting on Illusions by Cypress Hill and putting a towel under the door, you know, lighting an incense, cracking a window, and just chiefing down. And that song has such a long fucking intro, but like, that's when I'd load my bowl. And so by the time I'd have my bowl ready, like, they'd start rapping or whatever. And it was dope, you know. And like, the girl that my buddy brought with him, she was like, who is that? Is that ICP? And I was like, are you fucking kidding me? Like, there's no fucking way that you're going to confuse Cypress Hill for ICP. But I guess it's a certain flavor, you know. And on the way up there, my buddy had asked for, he said, he's like, all the last couple concerts that I've been to for Sublime, they've all played all their newer music, and they don't play the older stuff. And he's like, I really hope they play their older stuff. And both Cypress Hill and Sublime played a bunch of their their newer shit, you know, like, or their older shit, I mean, like all the classics, like fucking Hits from the Bong, man, Cypress Hill probably had a bigger effect on me than Sublime, but I was blown away by the showmanship of Sublime. Like they played a really good show. And Rome, that singer guy, he's fantastic. He has a great attitude. He's very charismatic, and he's a good fucking singer. And I was very just happy to be able to be part of and see that fucking performance, man. So I'm learning now the importance of doing things for ourselves, and that requires sacrifice in the exchange of energy output sometimes, but also just sacrifice and willingness. But these things are so worth it, and it's so valuable to be able to go and pursue this, you know? Pursue things that interest you, and pursue things that are exciting and give you a feeling of fulfillment. And the word in philosophy, kind of related to that, would be hedonism, which there's an extreme end of hedonism, which can be very dangerous. You know, hedonism being a philosophy based in the idea that the ultimate goal in life is pursuing pleasure. You know, and I heard this excellent take where this dude basically took like basic pleasure, and then he like broke it into a more specific terms, and one of them was satisfaction. And satisfaction takes, again, sacrifice. It takes hard work. It takes usually some sort of giving up something. But satisfaction is fulfillment, I feel like. And it can be based in pleasures. You know, you can have certain things that make you feel good, but usually it's not just something as easy as, you know, smoking crack rock. Like, if it's something you can hit, it's probably not as satisfying, at least in the long run. It might be satisfying at first. But something that's long-term satisfying is something that you spend a lot of time on, and a lot of time sacrificing and putting forth effort. And like this last couple weeks, I have been so exhausted because of the work and the driving and the blah, 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 that in my head, post experience, I found that I had wasted so much time before the experience with all these negative abstractions about tiredness. And honestly, each and all of those days, if you examine them piece by piece and frame by frame, there were some hard moments, just like life always has to offer. But none of those days were particularly like I was not exhausted for any of those days. And I had certain points of enjoyment, just like I did have certain parts of distress. There was this equal mixture, because that's the elixir of life, and that's how things are subjugated when phenomena comes to us as we experience this new moment, and then this new one, and this new one right now. But I feel ready, and I'm very happy that I have this time to myself right now. Like, on my calendar, I had freedom written on this day that I'd written almost 2 weeks ago, when I'd been pitying my position, looking at the top of this mountain. Oh, I gotta work 14 days in a row. Like, I got something really better to do, right? Like, do I really have something better to do other than support myself, at least in this society? I mean, obviously, there's something better to do. I could be building my commune in a forest somewhere and growing marijuana and Mimosa hostilis for DMT extractions. But at the moment, I'm supporting my son, and I have an apartment to pay for, and I've been so stressed about hours being cut and needing work. And all of a sudden, here I am working and doing things that are productive, and I'm doing things that are fulfilling. You know, not only did I go to a wedding last weekend, but I also brought Odin up to see his grandmother, because his entire family lives up in northern Colorado. And his mother's family is quite large and expansive. And there's lots of aunts and uncles, and they've been there for so long that they're very entrenched into the social structures of this town. And I haven't been able to bring Odin up there in about 2 years, I feel like. I hope it hasn't been more than 2 years. It might be less, but it's definitely been longer than a year. And in the act of pitying not wanting to go, because I had set up so much anxiety about not wanting to do the thing, that I even tried to talk myself into trying to quit the thing over and over again. And one of the ways that I jinxed myself into actually going is I tied something that I found of more importance to it. And in this situation, the thing of importance that I tied to it was Odin seeing his grandmother and his sister. His grandmother has full custody of his sister, and mom's pretty MIA still, unfortunately. She told me some stuff, but none of it seemed great. And it seems that Aphrodite, which is Odin's sister, hasn't seen Mama much either, which is terrible, you know. But the ability to have them together, and I have pictures. I have these wonderful pictures of these two kids playing, and they get along so well, and they were just so excited to see each other, you know. And so I couldn't quit that. There's no way that I was going to walk away or try to cancel that, despite snow or rain. And as soon as I'd made that call, that sort of commitment was stone cold. And so I used that to be able to get up there. And that sort of stuff, even though it's me sitting in this family's house with a lady that doesn't mind me much anymore, but when I was younger and when his mother was pregnant with him, and when he was younger, and when I was in the action of starting to become more of the primary caretaker, I was looked on with this negative affect, and the whole family thought that I was going to take their grandbaby away from them. And that was never something that I intended to do. But over the last almost decade, because it's been about 10 years since she got pregnant, over the last decade, I seem to have grown on the lady quite a bit, and she doesn't mind me. And so we can sit and talk for several hours, and then eventually it gets quiet, and she ends up playing on her computer, and I'll watch whatever TV show she's got on cable, and then the kids will run around and make a mess, and they just have a heyday. Like it's some of the happiest times that I've ever seen my son is when he's able to see his sister. And that sort of, it's not quite a sacrifice because I don't mind it. That's the thing. It's like I don't mind being there. It's not the best. I'd much rather work on my projects at home by myself in an isolated fashion because I'm an introvert. But I don't mind sitting in a lady's house. But that sort of experience is supremely satisfying, knowing that I can do that for my son. You know, and that's pleasurable. That gives me strength, and I know it gives my son strength, but being able to give and to support and do something for another person that's important like that is satisfying. And so that circumspects the idea of giving to others, which is important because we're social beings and we need to practice this altruism, this charity, this compassion, this respect for others, and not just humans. That also applies to plants and little fishes and all the other little guys. But we also have to be able to look into ourselves and see inside that important little aspect, that I spect, that I, that me, that you. What can you do in that sacrificial role to better your position and treat you and to help you? And it's not your favorite thing. It's not a base, easy pleasure. But when you're at the end of doing that thing, which might be giving time, which might be working hard so that you can save up enough to be able to do it, that satisfaction that comes from that self-care which is a ritual, so these self-care rituals that we can do, just like the concert, just like the wedding. But I think it's incredibly important to consider. And that's why I'm bringing it up this afternoon, because it's not the morning. Unfortunately, I didn't get to it this morning because I slept in because I was tired. But I would really think that you should consider these things and to maybe make a list of things that you would like to do. And it might be fun, and it might not be. But work on some sort of satisfaction goal. Think about the complexity to this goal. Think about base pleasures that are inherent in it. Think about the pleasure that comes from the ultimate satisfaction after the sacrifice. And I would really like to hear about it. My email address for the show is thegingerbreadmansdialogues@gmail.com. And if you look in the show notes, which is in the little description bar somewhere near the podcast player that you're looking at this on, you can find that email address if you want to copy and paste it, because I know it's very long. But if you'd like any assistance or would just like to share your journey in looking towards what you find satisfying, or if you need some sort of help in constructing some sort of list or things, please email me and we can work together. And this can be a give and take. I want this to be a community based thing. I'm doing this to be helpful. I want to make something that's going to help you. I don't just want to spread my ego and share what I've been doing. I'm trying to relate to you. I'm trying to find some way to show you that you're not alone and that a lot of your experiences are relatable. And I want to help. So you can reach out to me whenever you want. You have a friend in me. And now I'm going to go find Island, and I'm going to continue off where we were a couple weeks back, because I know I skipped a couple weeks because I was just exhausted, but I want to continue reading that last chapter. If you haven't listened to the last episode that I played right before this one, I don't know exactly when it was chronologically, but at the end of that is the beginning of this chapter that I may or may not finish right now. And so please go back to the last episode and listen to that one before you listen to the end of this one. All right, I'll be right back. I've guesstimated where I think I was when I ended up on the last episode. I think logically it'll still make sense. This is where Will was talking about how characters in the music were reminding him of these philosophical characters that are being used in the modern philosophical perspective, one of those being logical positivism. He has taken the moksha medicine, and he is starting to digress into his mind. And his trip sitter is this lady named Suzla, who, for this community, her job is basically to help people through difficult emotional events. And she's kind of like a hypnotist, and she's able to talk to people, and using her words and voice is able to calm them. And so she's sitting with him to help guide this experience, which is something that a lot of people are actually trying to do nowadays in the new psychedelic landscapes. Here we go. In the eternity that was as real as shit, he went on listening to these interwoven streams of sound, went on looking at these interwoven streams of light, went on actually being out there in here and nowhere, all that he saw and heard. And now abruptly, the character of the light underwent a change. These interwoven streams, which were the first fluid differentiations of an understanding on the further side of all particular knowledge, had ceased to be a continuum. Instead, there was, all of a sudden, this endless succession of separate forms. Forms still manifestly charged with a luminous bliss of undifferentiated being, but limited now, isolated, individualized. Silver and rose, yellow and pale green and gentian blue. An endless succession of luminous spheres came swimming up from some hidden source of form, and in time with the music, purposefully constellated themselves into arrays of unbelievable complexity and beauty. an inexhaustible fountain that sprayed out into conscious patternings, into lattices of living stars. And as he looked at them, as he lived their life, and the life of this music that was their equivalent, they went on growing into other lattices that filled the three dimensions of an inner space and changed incessantly in another, timeless dimension of quality and significance. "What are you hearing?" Suzula asked. "Hearing what I see," he answered, "and seeing what I hear." "And how would you describe it?" "What it looks like," Will answered after a long silence. "What it sounds like is the creation. Only it's not a one-shot affair. It's nonstop, perpetual creation." "Perpetual creation out of no what, nowhere into something somewhere, is that it?" "That is it." "You're making progress." If words had come more easily, and when spoken, had been a little less pointless, Will would have explained to her that knowledgeless understanding and luminous bliss were a damn sight better than even Johann Sebastian Bach. "Making progress," Suzula repeated. "But you've still got a long way to go. What about opening your eyes?" Will shook his head emphatically. "It's time you gave yourself a chance of discovering what's what." "What's what is this?" he muttered. "It isn't," she assured him. "All you've been seeing and hearing and being is only the first what. Now you must look at the second one. Look, and then bring the two together into a single inclusive what's what. So open your eyes, Will. Open them wide." "All right," he said at last, and reluctantly. With an apprehensive sense of impending misfortune, he opened his eyes. The inner illumination was swallowed up in another kind of light. The fountain of forms, the colored orbs in their conscious arrays, and purposefully changing lattices gave place to a static composition of uprights and diagonals, of flat planes and curving cylinders, all carved out of some material that looks like living agate, and all emerging from a matrix of living and pulsating mother of pearl. Like a blind man, newly healed and confronted for the first time by the mystery of light and color, he stared in uncomprehending astonishment. And at the end of another 20 timeless bars of the fourth Brandenburg, a bubble of explanation rose into consciousness. He was looking, Will suddenly perceived, at a small square table. And beyond the table, there was a rocking chair. And beyond the rocking chair, at a blank wall of whitewashed plaster. The explanation was reassuring, for in the eternity that he had experienced between the opening of his eyes and the emergent knowledge of what he was looking at, the mystery confronted him and had deepened from inexplicable beauty to a consummation of shining alienness that filled him, as he looked, with a kind of metaphysical terror. Well, this terrifying mystery consisted of nothing but two pieces of furniture and an expansive wall. The fear was allayed, but the wonder only increased. How is it possible that things so familiar and commonplace could be this? Obviously, it wasn't possible. And yet there it was. There it was. His attention shifted from the geometrical constructions and the brown agate to the pearly background. Its name, he knew, was Wall. But an inexperienced fact, it was a living process, a continuous series of transubstantiations from plaster and whitewash into the stuff of a supernatural body, into a god flesh that kept modulating as he looked at it from glory to glory, out of what the word bubbles had tried to explain away as mere calcimine, some shaping spirit was evoking an endless succession of the most delicately discriminated hues, at once faint and intense. They emerged out of latency and went flushing across the god body's divinely radiant skin. Wonderful, wonderful. And there must be other miracles, new worlds to conquer and be conquered by. He turned his head to the left, and there, appropriate words had bubbled up almost immediately, was the large marble-topped table at which they had eaten their supper. And now, thick and fast, more bubbles began to rise. This breathing apocalypse called Table might be thought of as a picture by some mystical cubist, some inspired Juan Gris with the soul of a Traherne, and a gift for painting miracles with conscious gems and the changing moods of a water lily petal. Turning his head a little further to the left, he was startled by a blaze of jewelry. And what strange jewelry. Narrow slabs of emerald and topaz, of ruby and sapphire and lapis lazuli, blazing away, row above row, like so many bricks in a wall of the New Jerusalem. Then, at the end, not in the beginning, came the word. In the beginning were the jewels, the stained glass windows on the wall of paradise. It was only now, at long last, that the word bookcase presented itself for consideration. Will raised his eyes from the book jewels and found himself at the heart of a tropical landscape. Why? Where? Then he remembered that, when, in another life, he first entered the room. He had noticed, over the bookcase, a large bat watercolor. Between sand dunes and a clump of palm, a widened estuary receding towards the open sea, and above the horizon, enormous mountains of cloud towered into a pale sky. Feeble came bubbling up from the shadows. The work, only too obviously, of a not very gifted amateur. But that was now beside the point, for the landscape had ceased to be a painting and was now the subject of the painting. A real river, real sea, real sand glaring in the sunshine. Real cheese against real sky. Real to the nth. Real to the point of absoluteness. And this real river, mingling with a real sea, was his own being engulfed in God. God, between quotation marks, inquired in ironic bubble, or God, in a modernist Pequinian sense. Will shook his head. The answer was just plain God. The God one couldn't possibly believe in, but who is self-evident, the fact confronting him. And yet, this river was still a river, the sea, the Indian Ocean, not something else in a fancy dress. Unequivocally themselves. But at the same time, unequivocally God. That's a hard word. Where are you now? Suzla asked. Without turning his head in her direction, Will answered, in heaven, I suppose, and pointed at the landscape. In heaven? Still? When are you going to make a landing down here? Another bubble of memory came up from the stilted shadows. Somewhere far more deeply interfused, whose dwelling is the light of something or other? But Wordsworth also talked about the still sad music of humanity. Luckily, said Will, there are no humans in this landscape. Not even animals? She added with a little laugh. Only clouds and the most deceptively innocent looking vegetables. That's why you'd better look at what's on the floor. Will dropped his eye. The grain on the floorboards was a brown river, and the brown river was an eddying, ongoing diagram of the world's divine life. At the center of that diagram was his own right foot, bare under the straps of its sandal, and startlingly three-dimensional, like a marble foot, revealed by a searchlight or some heroic statue. Boards? Grain? Foot? Through the glib explanatory words, the mystery stared back at him, impenetrable and yet paradoxically understood. Understood with that knowledge, that understanding to which, in spite of sensed objects and remembered names, he was still open. Suddenly, out of the tail of his eye, he caught a glimpse of a quick darting movement. Openness to bliss and understanding was also, he realized, an openness to terror, to complete incomprehension. Like some alien creature lodged within his chest and struggling in anguish, his heart started to beat with a violence that made him tremble. In the hideous certainty that he was about to meet the essential horror, Will turned his head and he looked. It's one of Tom Krishna's pet lizards, she said reassuringly. The light was as bright as ever, but the brightness had changed its sign. A glow of sheer evil radiated from every gray-green scale of the creature's back. From its obsidian eyes and the pulsing of its crimson throat, from the armored edges of its nostrils and its slit-like mouth. He turned away. In vain. The essential horror glared out of everything he looked at. Those compositions by the mystical cubist, they had turned into intricate machines for doing everything malevolently. That tropical landscape, in which he had experienced the union of his own being with the being of God, it was now simultaneously the most nauseating of Victorian oleographs and the actuality of hell. On their shelves, the rows of book jewels beamed with 1,000 watts of darkness visible. And how cheap those gems of the abyss had become, how indescribably vulgar. Where there had been gold and pearl and precious stones, there were only Christmas tree decorations, only the shallow glare of plastic and varnished tin. Everything still pulsed with life, but with the life of an infinitely sinister bargain department basement. And that, the music now affirmed, that was what omnipotence was perpetually creating. A cosmic Woolworth stocked with mass-produced horror. Horrors of vulgarity and horrors of pain, of cruelty and tastelessness, of imbecility and deliberate malice. Not a gecko, he heard Sula saying. Not one of our nice little house lizards. A hulking stranger from outdoors. One of those bloodsuckers. Not that they suck blood, of course. They merely have red throats and go purple in the face when they get excited. Hence that stupid name. Look, there he goes. We'll look down again. Preternaturally real, the real horror with its black blank eyes, its murderous mouth, its blood red throat pumping away while the rest of the body lay stretched along the floor as still as death, was now within 6 inches of his foot. He's seen his dinner, said Suzla. Look over there to your left on the edge of that matting. He turned his head. Gunglius gungliodius, she went on. Do you remember? Yes, he remembered. The praying mantis that had settled on his bed. But that was in another existence. What he had seen then was merely a rather odd-looking insect. What he saw now was a pair of inch-long monsters, exquisitely grisly, in the act of coupling. All right. I think that's enough for today. But we will we'll definitely finish this one eventually. I'm really committed to reading this entire chapter out in its entirety. So I know my performance is amateur, but this is my favorite way to try to share this with you. And just so anybody's listening, I'm not using any of this material for profit. This is all free commercial use. Like it's for just for educative purposes. I'm not selling anything. I don't make any profit. But I would love to have this accessible to you. And I know it would be kind of chunky to listen to them all at once. Maybe one day I'll just reread it in one episode. Like eventually I want to do like the Tao, and I was considering doing little mini episodes in the middle of the week where I do a couple verses of the Tao and maybe a little bit of light commentary. I might start doing that soon, but we'll see. Either way, it's a highly compelling narrative. And as far as descriptiveness goes, Aldous Huxley, who's the author of this tremendous work, Island, is a master of the craft, and he's one of my favorites. So thank you at the least for allowing me to share that with you. I'm going to go find Odin, and then we'll sign you off, and I'll see you next week.
Hello, it's Ask O and the Gingerbread Man again.
Woohoo!
We've been back for 2 weeks, I think.
Yeah, it's been about 2 weeks. Good job.
Yeah. So, how you guys doing, you know?
You know? How are you doing, O?
I'm good. I'm good.
That's fine. This is Ask O. Everybody knows who you are. You're safe. This is my show.
I know, but... So, how you guys been doing? I bet you guys been doing good. Sorry, we've been not really posting a lot of the recording, but how can I tell you why? Because we had to drive to Loveland, see my grandma, and also go to a wedding.
What'd you think of that?
It was crazy. I'm the same.
Well, I'm glad you had some fun.
But it was all snowy.
Yeah. Well, do you have any advice to give to any of your friends this week?
Nah, sorry.
No advice. That's fine, too. Sometimes we don't need to give advice. Sometimes we just need to let people do their thing, huh?
Yeah. That's true.
Okay. Well, hope you guys have a great week. Mm-hmm. Bye.